J.W. McGarvey said of this book, "The title, which this short form assigns itself, is The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. If there is anything in the book, if there is any book in the Bible which found a place in it by mistake or misjudgment of those who put the inspired book together, it must be this, for it is totally unlike all the rest, and it is difficult to see what connection it can have with the general design of the whole. Many interpreters have affected to find in it a parabolic meaning, and even a foreshadowing of the love of Christ in the church, while others have regarded it as nothing more than a love song with a very obscure connection or thought. According to either view, it has afforded little edification to the great majority of Bible readers, and unless some significance can be found in it hereafter, which has not yet been pointed out, it will continue to be but little read and of little practical value." J.W. McGarvey, A Guide to Bible Study in 1897. He had a problem with the book. Some are thought to have questions its inclusion in the canon because of, one, its description of the physical body, and number two, the absence of the name of God. The New Testament contains no direct reference to the references to this book, Smith points out in his book. Now, I must stop here. In Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, the 8th chapter and the 6th verse, there is a variant reading. And if you, the Pew Bibles or the New King James, and if you'll read in there, you're going to find that the name of the Lord and God is not found. They translated fervent fire rather than fire of the Lord. And it's because it's an abbreviated name of God. But in all actuality, the scholars have now concluded that the New King James is accurate. It's an accurate translation of fervent flame or fervent fire in that passage. So therefore, the name of God, it's one of those books, the name of God is not mentioned in. Some early Christians considered this book dangerous. Jerome once wrote a letter to his disciple Paula to give her a Bible reading plan for her daughter's proper education. She should start with the Psalter and then proceed to Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. The Gospel should come next, Acts and the Epistles. She should then study the prophets, the Pentateuch, and the Old Testament historical books, and quote, "When she has done all these, she may safely read the Song of Songs, but not before, for were she to read it at the beginning, she would fail to perceive that though it is written in fleshly words, it is a marriage song of the spiritual bridal, and not understanding this, she would suffer from it." Origen and Jerome tell us that the Jews forbade the song to be read by any until he was 30 years old. Rabbi Akiba is reported to have said, "He who trills his voice in chanting the Song of Songs in a banquet halls and makes it a secular song has no share in the world to come." In other words, these guys had a real problem with it. Even commentaries that we're all familiar with. Adam Clark said this, "I advise all young ministers to avoid preaching on Solomon's Song." He was very straightforward. Well, this book has attracted a lot of controversy, and this afternoon we're going to try to find out why, and we're going to try to see if we can solve some of the obvious treptitude by which we approach this book. The name of the book is Song of Psalms, or in the Latin, Canticle of Canticles, in the Douay Bible, and still is today. The Hebrew title, Shir Hashirim, means Song of Songs, and literally probably should be titled that. It may mean the greatest or sweetest of all songs, in the same way that King of Kings, 1 Timothy 6:15, Revelation 17:14, means Supreme King. Whenever it comes to the authorship of the book of Song of Solomon, it would seem to be just a given that Solomon wrote it. But because of the highly allegorical views taken throughout history and the typological views, if you will, taken of this book, there are some who, because of the name of the word Solomon meaning peace and Shulamite meaning peace, also take this that it could have been written at any time. And they said that if we're going to say that it's typological or allegorical, then why not make the names and the whole experience fictitious? And why not allow it to be come up at any time? But fortunately, the Jews were very clear. They believed it to be penned by Solomon, and there is really no question, except by higher critics, that he is the author of this book. So let's talk a little bit about the author, because of his experiences and why he wrote this book. After David's adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband Uriah the Hittite, King David married Bathsheba, and to them was born a son who was to inherit the throne of Israel, Solomon. According to 2 Samuel, Solomon's other name was Jedidiah, beloved of Yahweh, 2 Samuel 12, verse 24 and 25. Solomon's ascension to the throne, his prayer to God for wisdom, his great wealth, his building the temple, his prayer of dedication, all of this are well preserved in Kings and Chronicles. But let's look back to the young, humble Solomon and his prayer to God, because this book deals with Solomon, I believe, in his youth. In 1 Kings 3 and verse 5 through 15, the Bible records, "And the Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God asked, 'What are you, or what do you wish me to give to you?' Then Solomon said, 'You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, accordingly, as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. You have reserved for him this great loving kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, yet I am but a little child.'" Notice how he viewed himself. "I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who are too many to be counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?" The Bible goes on to record, "It was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, 'Because you have asked this thing and not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, or have asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment and understanding and justice, behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so there has been none like you, nor shall there be one arise after you that is like you.'" And then he goes ahead and says, "And he awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came before Jerusalem, stood before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and offered burnt sacrifices and made peace offerings and a feast for all of his servants." 1 Kings 3. In 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, the scriptures go on to tell us about what Solomon accomplished, some of the things he accomplished. "Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore." I'm reading from the New American Standard. "Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Elam, the Ephraimite, Heman, Colchah, Darna, and sons of Mahal, and his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He spoke over 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Please make note of this. Next phrase, too. "He spoke of trees, from the cedars that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssops that grow on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish." Now, why would the Bible include that kind of information in there? I think we're going to find that answered when we get to the book of Solomon, Song of Solomon, and also it's going to affect some of the ways we interpret it. Just this slight little verse here. "Men came from all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from the kings of the earth who heard of his wisdom." Of the 105,000 psalms, that we only have three recorded for us. In Psalm 72, Psalms 127, as LG has pointed out, and the Song of Songs. And note, by the way, in this song that it contains the names of 18 plants and 13 animals. Evidently, Solomon was very wise. He spent time learning about plants and animals. Most commentators assign the date of the song to the early part of Solomon's reign, 970 to 950 BC. At the time of the writings, there were only 60 queens and 80 concubines, chapter 6 and verse 8. Later, there were 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, 1 Kings 11 and verse 3. Therefore, this must have been Solomon's early reign. In fact, some commentators say that by this time, Solomon was not enticed to marry foreign wives, that most of these wives were matters of convenience or politics, and that he wasn't practicing polygamy. He would just marry these people to make covenants with people of the land around about them. Well, Solomon's early godly years were followed by a spiritual decline, obviously, and an extended time in his life when he was not walking with God. Toward the end of his life, he apparently returned to close fellowship with God, if you date Ecclesiastes, toward the end of his life. Ecclesiastes seems to have been written toward the end of Solomon's life to give testimony to the king searching for meaning in life. His conclusions are that life only makes sense when God is at the center of all we undertake, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13 and verse 14. The author is Solomon. He is wise. He brings a great deal of knowledge to this writing. So, let's look at the ways to view the book. And by the way, I'm limiting myself to an introduction to this book today. So, we'll talk about that more later. But anyway, how do we view this book? How do we view it? Well, you can view it as a collection of songs or poems. Some think that the book is not a unit, but rather a collection of wedding songs used at wedding festivals and are still used today, by the way, in some Middle Eastern countries. In fact, whenever I was doing searches on the internet, I came across not only original CDs of these wedding songs, but English translations of these songs as well. I didn't know that they translated them that way, but anyway. The difficulty of tracing the logical connection between the different parts of the poem, even in the Hebrew text, have contributed to the song being considered an anthology of love songs, perhaps by different authors, rather than a single work by one author writing with a unified plan in mind. But the Song of Solomon does seem to have a plot which develops. It is not likely that a collection of isolated poems would provide a story that coalesces such as this. The unity of the book is demonstrated in the fact that Solomon's name is prominent throughout the song. Chapter 1 and chapter 3 and chapter 8, verse 11 and 12. By the reoccurrence of similar words, illustrations, and figures throughout the passages, and he uses them in chapter 2, chapter 6, and everything. In other words, it's not just isolated to a few places. These things are continuously used throughout the book. And furthermore, the bride's family that's mentioned in this passage, her mother and her brothers are consistently mentioned, but never her father in chapter 1, verse 6, and we'll talk more about that later. It's also then construed by some to be a unified just love song or love ballad. This view makes the song an epithalamo, a marriage song, recording the love and the marriage of Solomon and his queen. Still others have suggested that this book is a drama. It's a drama, and not in a theoretical sense, since the theater was not a Semitic institution, but a development somewhere between lyrical poetry and drama. Could you put a, turn it on first and see which one's up there. Yes. The New King James Version, which by the way is very accurate, you might find that very accurate on the Song of Solomon, In the way they present their text, they divide up the Hebrew number and gender of the words for you. They place them right in the text, and they did a good job of it. Now, there's always a little bit of disagreement, especially when you get to the plurals. Sometimes you're not sure who's speaking, and it has to be determined contextually. But the New King James did the scholars that worked on it did a really good job of working with this and trying to identify who the speakers are. Because without this identification, it is really confusing to see the flow of the thought, the flow of the argument, if you will. So the New King James does a real good job of this. And I noticed that the ones you have in your pews are an update of this, the 90 version, which does a few changes in the headings. But some consider this to be a drama. Once again, Bullitt, which is a great book, by the way, on an introduction to Old Testament prophetic books. It would be something like a dramatic reading with identifiable speakers, or in this case, singers. Origen is first suggested that the song should be interpreted as a marriage song in the form of a drama, if you will. And that, what I mean by this is that it doesn't have curtains, and you don't have people coming back and forth on stage. It's more like a dramatic reading with people in the background, if you will. And Frank Delitzsch gave strong support to this view in the mid-1800s. of Kylan DeLitch fame, if you will. Well, let's look at the story. Let's try to see the plot then, if we pull it together. And I'm going to point out one big discrepancy between two views or plots of this story. Because of the difficulty of determining who's speaking, the plot is difficult to follow. Several speakers appear in the song, although which one enters and leaves is not always clear, especially in the English translation. But Unger, in his Bible handbook, summarizes H.A. Ironside's description of the plot in the following ways. King Solomon had a vineyard in the hill country of Ephraim, about 50 miles north of Jerusalem, chapter 8, verse 11. He let it out to keepers, chapter 8, verse 11, consisting of a mother and two sons, chapter 1, verse 6, and two daughters, the Shulamite, chapter 6, verse 13, and a little sister, chapter 8, verse 8. The Shulamite was the Cinderella of the family, chapter 1, verse 5, naturally beautiful but unnoticed. Her brothers were likely half-brothers, in other words, because she says, my mother's sons. When your sister says that about you, you know you've got a problem with them. This is not my brother. This is my mother's sons. So she often thinks that they're half-brothers, if you will. They make her work very hard in tending the vineyards so that she has little opportunity to care for her personal appearance, chapter 1, verse 6. She prunes the vines and sets traps for the little foxes, chapter 2, verse 15. She also kept flocks, chapter 1, verse 8. Being out in the open so much, she became sunburned, chapter 1, verse 5. One day, a handsome stranger came into the vineyard. It was Solomon in disguise. I'm reading from Unger here. It was Solomon in disguise. He showed an interest in her, and she became embarrassed concerning her personal appearance. She took him for a shepherd and asked him about his flocks, chapter 1, verse 7. He answered evasively, but also spoke loving words to her and promised rich gifts for the future. He won her heart and left her with the promise that someday he would return. She dreamed of him at night and sometimes thought he was near. Finally, he did return in all of his kingly splendor to make her his bride. Now that's one plot of this. And basically, the difference between this one and the next one is Solomon kind of disguises himself and doesn't really let the shepherd girl know who he is until he kind of surprises her toward the end, kind of like a Cinderella story. Well, because it's hard to follow, still others have suggested another plot. And another popular view is put forward by Arthur G. Clarke. And he gets quite descriptive in his definition. Please listen. There lived at Shechem, also known as Shechem, a humble family consisting of a widowed mother with two or more sons and a virtuous young daughter, the maiden of the song. The family seems to have had a double occupation. Besides shepherding fox, they take care of certain vineyards, and they have owned a field or simply held as tenants. During the course of her duties in caring for the young of the flock, the maiden becomes acquainted with a shepherd youth. And one day, about noon, while resting their flocks at a woodland spot near the goat's home, there under a certain tree, which it became a trysting place, the shepherd first declared his love and found to his joy a response in the maiden's heart. Mutual vows of fidelity seemed to appear to have been exchanged. According to Eastern custom, upon the death of the father's maidens, the father of the maiden's brothers, who were older, assumed responsibility with the mother for arranging in due course the sister's marriage. The brothers did not look with favor upon the growing intimacy of the young couple and makes efforts to hinder their communication. The purpose, no doubt, was to protect their sister's reputation and that of the family. The mother seems to have taken a more lenient view, not only encouraging the young people, but later on at that same outlet spot, confirming the lover's vows by a more formal pledge of betrothal. One lovely spring day, the maiden sets out on a visit to a nut grove in her favorite valley, and she desires to open and enjoy the fresh venue of the countryside. Suddenly, and quite unexpectedly, she comes upon King Solomon and his venue returning from an excursion to his northern territories. The king's observant eye lights upon the damsel. Struck by her unusual beauty, this too susceptible heart immediately determines to make her a member of his already large harem. It is probable that she turned to flee, but the royal command is seized and committed to the care. She is seized and committed to the care of the court ladies, then conveyed to the royal residence, or as some think, to the king's pavilion at a nearby encampment. It is not at all unlikely then that Solomon has her taken to Jerusalem, where she's handed over to the care of women. Amid the splendor of the royal palace, the king renews his attentions. The Shulamite is first promised gifts of jewelry, and then when his offers fail, its purpose, he later offers her advancement in station among the ladies of the court circle. Her resolve, however, is unshaken. She preserves her maidenly dignity and remains loyal to her betrothed shepherd lover, for whom she has been unwillingly separated. All the king's banishments, offers of inducements, all the luxuries of the court life mean nothing to her but the pure soul of this country maid. Her thoughts constantly dwell upon her absent beloved. Her heart is full of him and him only. Solomon comes at last to realize his utter failure of his advances. It is something new to his experience of the fair sex. Impressed by such virtue and consistency, he grants permission for the Shulamite to return home. Joyfully, she sends word to her beloved to come and escort her there. And this invitation, the shepherd eagerly responds. The story ends with a touching description of the homeward journey. Readers are permitted to overhear, or to, so to speak, snatches of the lover's conversation as they near home. Now, these are all very fanciful descriptions, but there's one big problem when really understanding the plot of this text. Some, you have to identify whether there is a shepherd lover that is separate from Solomon, or if Solomon and the shepherd lover are the same person. That is the problem. J.W. McGarvey accepts the view that there was this contest going on between the wealth and the position that Solomon's offering this young girl and the simple country bumpkin that she loved that wanted her to come back home, and she wanted to go back home to him. And therefore the virtue of the story is that their love can't be bought, and love and power will not win the day. Well, McGarvey says King Solomon takes the Shulamite to his court and attempts by flattery and magnificent promises to separate from her lover, to whom, after she remains faithful, at last restored. The book is a beautiful tribute to true and constant love, which no wealth can dazzle and no power can overawe. It is a refreshing picture of virtue to be found among the common people in the greatest splendor of growing corruption in the court of Solomon, and the spiritual lessons of the book are not to be found in mystical allusions to Christ in the church, but in the purity and constancy of true love, lessons needed in no other age other than our own. Well, are these two the same person, or are they not? Well, F.C. Cook takes the position, there is but one lover in the song, and the one object of his affection. How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
Okay. And one object of his affection, without rival or disturbing influence on either side. The beloved of the bride is in truth a king. And if she occasionally speak of him as a shepherd, she intimates that she is speaking figuratively. Being herself a rustic maiden of comparatively low station, she, by such an appellation, seeks to draw him down, whom her soul loves, chapter 1 and verse 7, chapter 3, verse 1 through 4. Though he be the king of Israel, within her narrow circle of thoughts and aspirations. In other words, she uses terminology that is familiar to her in order to express her appreciation of this man. She uses her own palette or language, her own vocabulary, to describe her heart of the king. It's not because he is a shepherd. It's because this is terminology that she is familiar with, and he also is familiar with. Remember, he knew all kinds of plants, and he knows all kinds of animals. They are used repeatedly in this book. There's no sense to think that the court here, or this person, Solomon, was so separated by his regality and royalty that he was unfamiliar with the animals and plants. The Bible takes time to tell us Solomon familiarized himself with these plants and animals, and then it would be understandable to understand why he would use them from his palate in trying to communicate with wisdom toward this girl who was a Shulamite, who was of lower estate, in his trying to communicate with her his view of her as well. Agreeing with this view, Kyle and DeLitch state, the course of the exposition will show that the shepherd who is distinguished from Solomon is nothing else than a shadow cast by the person of Solomon. The Song of Solomon can be outlined in the following ways, and it's difficult to outline it. If you take it as a drama, I'll put all this in the book. If you put it in the drama, you got all this, but this is the best way. The Song of Solomon can be outlined in this way. The courtship, falling in love, chapter 1, the wedding day, the wedding night, marital reality, marital delight, and marital homecoming. That is how to renew something that you've been struggling with, and we're going to talk, we're not going to talk about that, you'll have to read it later. But anyway, others have outlined the books in following ways, in the three adjurations of the book. I adjure you not to awaken my love before its time, chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4. Still others have simplified this book to pre-marriage, marriage, and post-marriage love. And there's one writer, which I thought was very good after studying. I came upon it late. But he said that the events that are happening in the Song of Solomon are happening immediately. In other words, the first part of before chapter 4, he's talking about just before the wedding ceremony. Chapter 4 is the wedding ceremony in the evening. And then the next one is married life after that. And he talks about what's going on in the first three chapters as being memories of their courtship, of her thinking back to how she got to know this man whom she's now going to call her husband. And there's some virtue in that for you as well. But ways of interpreting the book. The symbolic way of interpreting the book is basically divided into two categories. Allegory, that is not based on fact, if you will, or typical, which is based on fact. In other words, if you're going to take a typical view of this book, you have to first of all establish there was a real Solomon, there was a real marriage, there was a real queen, and this symbolized something else. But if you take the allegorical view, this is going to all be fictitious. An allegory was written. Most allegories aren't true to life. But this book seems true to life, folks. But if it's allegory, the allegory doesn't have to be. And the names could be symbolic. The events could be symbolic. In fact, what in the book is symbolic? In fact, it's difficult to answer. Many who have wrestled with this book said, if it's allegory, what does the 60 concubines mean? Don't they have an allegorious meaning? Or if it's typical, what do they mean? Or is it truly historical in its nature? Well, there's the Jewish allegorical view. The rabbinical view of the song depicts God's love for Israel as a wife. In contrast to the purity, joy, and vitality of the early love of Solomon and the Shulamite, the book of Hosea gives us the striking contrast of latter-day Israel as the unfaithful and adulterous wife of God. In other words, here you have a book that paints what God thinks of Israel and because of his love for them. And in Hosea, you get the exact opposite, a horrible marriage and what God thinks of them whenever everything goes wrong. Song of Solomon is when everything goes right, and Hosea is when everything goes wrong. That's an interesting view. Still others, another allegorical view of the Jews is that the song portrays the history of Israel from the Exodus to the age of the Messiah. The Chaldee Targum, the oldest Jewish commentary, takes this view of the book. And then there's the Christian allegorical view of the book. Many Christian commentators interpret the Song of Songs as a picture of Christ, as the bride of Christ. Adam Clark is a very good one on this. Paul writes to the Corinthians, and he tells them, using these New Testament passages, "For I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I have betrothed you to one husband, so that Christ I might present you as a pure virgin." 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. In other words, they say these passages show that God regards this church, Christ relationship in a husband-wife kind of light. And therefore we can take this view to the book of Song of Solomon as well. The woman in scripture is pictured as a type of the ordinary believer. Romans 7, 1 through 4. "Don't you know, brethren, that the law has jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives?" And I better wrap this up. Ephesians, the fifth chapter. Of course, I want to read verse 31, 32, and then we'll bring it to our conclusion. "For this reason, a man must leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great." Now, I want to point out that the Bible doesn't make mistakes, guys. He, in this two becoming one flesh in verse 31 is talking about sexuality. And it is from there that the next statement is found. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Now there is a very strong tie to looking at physical sexuality and in some way understanding that this intimate expression of care and concern and thoughtfulness of giving and taking and sharing, becoming one, is somehow to be understood to represent something wonderful about our relationship with Christ. But there are some problems with the allegorical view. The allegorical method of interpreting a book reigned supreme until the middle of the 9th century, Smith writes in his book. Then the tide began to turn, primarily due to two reasons. First, a more sophisticated biblical attitude toward human sexuality began to emerge. Secondly, the discovery of similar love poems in the countries surrounding Israel has caused scholars to realize that this type of literature was common to the region and to the time. This diminishes the likelihood that some special system of interpretation was intended for this particular book of love. Third, the increased realization that this method was totally subjective. Interpreters were more apt to find their own ideas in the text than to discern the author's intent. Let me be very clear. If you take an allegorical interpretation of the book of Psalm Solomon, you have to take the position that the author intended for it to be allegorical. Is it allegorical? Is it historical? Is it typological? You have to ask, what was the author's intent? A few examples that people have found difficulty with. My beloved is to me a bag of myrrh that lies between my breasts. Chapter 1, verse 13 is said by Jewish commentators Rashi and Ibn Ezra to represent the Shekinah glory of Yahweh that stood between the cherubim and the Holy of Holies. The interpretation of chapter 1, verse 13 in Christian circles was that the bag of myrrh is Christ and the woman's breasts are the Old and New Testament. Another classic example of allegory in chapter 7, verse 2, which reads, "Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine." According to some allegorists, this represents the sanctuary of the church where the communion wine is always present. John Waddy records that some believe, "I am black but comely," chapter 1, verse 5, means black with sin but comely through conversion. And the 80 concubines, chapter 6 and 8, were said to be heresies that have plagued the church. Now I want you to know that is purely subjective. You have no understanding. There's nothing within the text that suggests that interpretation. Which leads me to the last view, and that is the literal view. Its purpose is to celebrate and honor pure married love. John Wadley adds his belief that it is a veiled protest against polygamy. It may have been. The key verse is chapter 8 and verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all of his riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. The literal purpose, and Smith writes this very clearly. Smith writes, the literal purpose of the book has often been twisted by those who are not prepared to read frank and intimate expressions of love. This book undercuts the two main perversions of biblical sexuality. Asceticism and lust. Asceticism views sexuality as an evil to be avoided. Lust makes it the hub of life. Song pronounces the divine "it is good" upon sexual attraction, which leads to lifelong commitment and fidelity. If God created sexuality, why should the church stumble at the presence of her in an inspired canon of song extolling the dignity and beauty of human love and sexual attraction? Smith, page 831. God could have used medical terms or slang to speak of sex, but medical terms cause a sense of awkwardness, and we react negatively to slang. So God avoided both by expressing these delicate things in the language of poetry, symbols. Symbols say more than a medical or slang ever could, but without creating awkwardness or evoking negative reaction. Joseph C. Didlow on Solomon on Sex. Even if, and I want the last quote, is from the International Bible Encyclopedia. Even if Canticles is merely a collection of songs describing the bliss of true lovers in wedlock, it is not thereby rendered unworthy of a place in the Bible, unless marriage is to be regarded as a fall from a state of innocency. If Canticles should be rejected because of its sensuous imagery in describing the joys of passionate lovers, portions of Proverbs would also have to be excised. Proverbs 5, verse 15 through 20. Perhaps most persons need to enlarge their conception of the Bible as a repository for all things that minister to the welfare of men. The entire range of a man's legitimate joys finds sympathetic and appreciative description in the Bible. Two young lovers in paradise need not fear to rise and meet their Creator should He visit them in the cool of the day.